Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Simon Winchester has claimed many corners of the globe as his narrative terrain, from China to Indonesia, from the Balkans to his native England. He has explored the interwoven complexities of history, geography, biography, and science in his books. With his latest, The Men Who United the States, Winchester, who realized a long-held dream and became an American citizen in 2011, looks at his adopted country through the lens of the inventors, innovators, and explorers who have bound the sprawling nation together, facilitating the unification of the American landscape and the forging of a disparate population into a shared national identity. Again, the title of the book is The Men Who United the States, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Simon Winchester to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
Thank you very much. It's a delight.
I was so excited when I heard you were doing this, because this is great Simon Winchester fare in that you've taken this gigantic subject and have just winnowed it down into a beautiful story.
I hope what you say is true. It's the beginning of the process, and you sort of realize that when you write about a subject as written about by so many others already, you think, how are you possibly adding anything to the debate? And aren't there 100,000 nitpicking academics out there who may just destroy this? But thus far, people have been very nice about it. I think it's accepted that for a new-made American to look at America and say, how did this concept of unity come about, is actually a legitimate question.
One of the things that I think that brings on curiosity is, which came first? Is it this long-held dream that you had to look at the history, or is it through this history that this dream came to be?
It's a bit of both, and something additional as well. I mean, I wrote a book about America in 1976 called American Heartbeat, which was the most unsuccessful book I've ever written. In fact, I can confess to you now that when I got the royalty statement in 1977, and royalty is a bit of a joke, I had sold 12 copies. It was nicely reviewed, but nobody wanted to buy it. I had this idea that the essence of America lay in the American Midwest, and so I took 6 months off and drove up and down and up and down Interstate 35, which goes from Duluth, Minnesota, or if you push it a bit, International Falls, Minnesota, down to Laredo, Texas, and produced a book which was, frankly, to me, I thought it was fascinating, but the public thought it was a great big yawn. Fast forward then another 40 years or so, and I become an American, and I am sort of seized with the idea, well, I would like to have another go, because ever since I first visited America in 1963 and hitchhiked all around it, and people were so nice to me, and it was such an encouraging and wonderful experience, I've wanted to somehow get to grips with what makes this country tick. And clearly I did not perform well in 1976. Let's try again. And so this is a second attempt, completely different kind of structure, of course. It's a more mature book. I hope I can be at least given that. But it's also an attempt, I think, to, in a way, to, it sounds a rather grand ambition, but it's to remind people who, particularly, we've got, you know, all sorts of turmoil in Washington, all sorts of turmoil overseas, economy is not terribly good shape, to remind people that this is an extraordinary experiment, the United States, and it works pretty well. And there have been much worse periods in American history than this. I mean, the Dust Bowl, the Civil War, the Prohibition. I mean, what lunacy was that, that the Congress could actually pass a law banning the sale and production of liquor? Well, we got all of those things out of our system. Mm-hmm. New things have emerged to trouble us. But even so, the union remains strong. And this concept of a united country made of so many races and religions and colors and aspirations and beliefs, and yet it is one country. How has that managed, A, to come about, and B, to sustain itself?
What I love, and you had me from the very beginning, is just in its structure of looking at it through these elements of wood and earth and water and fire and metal, taking those things and telling this story. I assume that comes early in the process if you say, okay, this is how we're going to do it. Why those five?
Well, there had been other attempts beforehand. I wrote a number of proposals. I simply said to my publishers, I want to write a big book about America, celebrating my love affair with this country, if you like. So, well, they didn't think the basic idea of a hymn to America would quite work. I then came up with an idea of, because I love railway trains, of crossing America, as it's technically possible to do, on Class 3 freight trains. It's possible to go from Eastport in Maine to a place in Northern California entirely by freight train. But the permission to do that is incredibly difficult. And the publisher said, no, that's a book about railways. That's not really a book about America. So then I came up with an even more ludicrous idea, which was, for many years in Britain, there was a series done by Anthony Sampson called The Anatomy of Britain. And I thought, why not The Anatomy of America, but model it on Gray's Anatomy? So look at the universities as being the brain, look at the highways as being the arteries, look at the telephone system as being the nerves, and so on and so forth. They didn't think that was a good idea either. So there was one, two, three of these ideas. And then I thought, well, heck, I lived in China for a dozen years, and the concept of these five classical elements, of, as you mentioned, wood, earth, water, fire, and metal, is very sort of important and central to Eastern thinking from India onwards, and I lived there as well. Is it possible to look at the history of America through that kind of construct? And all of a sudden, it did come into focus. And because Lewis and Clark, who one might arguably say are the first unifiers of this country, in that they discovered how big it was and what its extent was, they plunged through forests, of which there were many more then than there are today, in wooden boats. Everything about them was to do with wood of one kind or another. Built wooden structures, they had campfires. Wood sort of worked. And then I thought, well, that's the first chapter seems to work. What about Earth? And then that's the early geologists. Because once Lewis and Clark had determined what America, what its extent was, then what was it made of? And it was up to the geologists. And that then sort of fell into focus as well, as did the other chapters. And so I put it to the editor one day, early in the process, would this work? And he said, you know, I think it will. The critics might have a field day with it, but let's see, it's worth taking the risk. And that's how the book has arrived at.
When you talk about risk, I was thinking about just the title of The Men Who United the States. With the exception of Sacagawea, this is a book that is dominated by men.
First of all, I want to say that the title, The Men Who United the States, is entirely down to my wife, Setsko, who said to me, so you're writing a book about the men who united the States. I said, Setsko, I love you. Yes, there's the title. She said, but what about the women? And I said, well, unfortunately, the reality is that in this particular story, there are very, very few women. Many of the stories relate to relationships with women, particularly as maybe we'll talk about this extraordinary man called Clarence King, who had very strange relationships with women. But Sacagawea aside, there are no women that play a hugely significant part in this story. And it would be an artificial construct to write a book called The Women Who United the States, because there weren't any. There were women who did other things of vast importance. But in this specific story, it's a very masculine tale.
That has an impact on our identity, doesn't it?
I suppose it does. I've never really thought of it like that. It would have been perhaps a rather different country if it had been, you know, women who made the canals and women who made the railway trains and invented the internet. And it might have been, as you say, a very different identity. But
and it sets us up for all of the fights that we have had over equal rights and civil rights and gay rights, and the list goes on and on.
Well, and having discussed that, I mean, there are certain things that bind this country together, which I specifically did not include in the book. I mean, for instance, I could have written about our language, the English language, and to an extent, of course, the Spanish language, as being unifying features. I could have talked about democracy and the rule of law and all those good things. But I decided that what binds this country physically is a hugely important and generally overlooked part of the story. So it is generally the physical uniting of the country. And in that physical story, it tends to be a masculine story.
Mm. And this gets back to your real background. I mean, you started as a geologist. This is the training that you had at Oxford years and years ago.
I wrote a book called The Map That Changed the World,
right,
about 10 or 15 years ago, about William Smith, who every self-respecting geologist in the world knows that William Smith created the first geological map of anywhere. Well, and I wrote a book believing that. Doing the research for this, I found it wasn't true. I found that the first geological map of anywhere was actually of this country, done 6 years before William Smith by a Scotsman called William McClure, who we've all forgotten about. And I was giving a lecture in London about this the other day, and they were shocked. I said, people come from all over the world to see William Smith's first map. Now, perhaps with the publication of this book, they may actually go to Philadelphia and see a completely different map, 6 years older than the one hanging up in London in pride of place, because McClure and his map of the Appalachians and of the original 13 states are done in 1809, really is the one that is the first in the world. So starting off with that, a number of my beliefs about geology were overturned in the research for this book. And the characters that I came across, Wheeler, King, as I talk about in a few moments, perhaps, John Wesley Powell, the one-armed man who managed to find and map the Grand Canyon, are extraordinary people who are not known about generally in Europe and are generally forgotten in this country too. And that's another aspect of this book, that an awful lot of the very important people who welded this country together, completely forgotten about.
What is equally fascinating of the construct of the book of using those five elements, but also of finding the characters that fit those, that construction. And to me, I would think that would be the fun part, finding these individuals, because one would assume, I would assume, knowing you and knowing your work, that you are looking for a certain type of individual that is going to be just a little bit off and ready to do something extraordinary.
Well, may I talk about Clarence King, who is a little bit off in
absolutely
big time.
Perfect segue.
Once McClure had produced a map, and once the very early and rather primitive geological surveys of this country had been done, President Lincoln decided the country had to be systematically surveyed, because we needed to know what America was made of and where the gold and the coal and the various minerals were. So he organized four surveys, very expensive surveys, one by a man called Wheeler, generally forgotten, who surveyed up in the Great Plains, one by a man called Hayden, who discovered Yellowstone, John Wesley Powell, who discovered, despite having only one arm, and made this amazingly courageous journey down the length of the Grand Canyon, who put the Grand Canyon on the map, and this remarkable man called Clarence King, who's, I think, one of the most extraordinary people in all of recent American history. He was given the task of doing what's called the 40th parallel survey, which was to produce a survey 100 miles to the north and south of a line from Sacramento in the west to Cheyenne in the middle of the country. So it took him 7 years to do it. He had a large party of workers, and they mapped every mountain and every valley and produced exquisite geological and topographical maps. I mean, to go to the antiquarian bookshops and find volumes detailing these, they cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're works of art. Anyway, as a consequence of this, this man, Clarence King, who was diminutive, very voluble, very talkative, great storyteller, cigar-smoking, white, Newport, Rhode Island aristocrat, educated at Yale with a PhD from Harvard, he was appointed to be the first ever director of a newly formed body, which still exists today, called the United States Geological Survey. So he was the first director of the USGS, based in New York. There's a thing about Clarence King, though, which wasn't realized generally, but other than known to his most intimate friends, which is that he had great disdain for white women. He liked Native American women or dark-skinned women. He never married until he was in his early 70s. And he was in New York, very distinguished fellow, honorary degrees and senior post in the United States government. Walking through Riverside Park one night, he saw a woman, a black woman, who instantly he said, this is the lady of my dreams. I wanted to take her to dinner and possibly enter into a relationship. What he did not do was to walk across to her and say, "Good afternoon, madam. I am Clarence King, director of the United States Geological Survey." He said, thinking very quickly on his feet, but perhaps not imagining the world of trouble it would get him into, he said, "My name is James Todd. I may look white, but I'm actually black, and I'm a porter on the Pullman railway system. Would you like to come to dinner?" Well, they liked each other. They married. They produced 5 children. But for the rest of his life, another 22 years, I think it was, he then lived, perhaps because he had to live, 2 entirely separate lives. He would go into the Geological Survey office and say, "Well, that was a long expedition. Anyway, I'm back now for a month." Having left his wife in Queens, Mrs. Todd said, "Well, I'm going off on the California Zephyr, and I'll be back in a month, and I hope I get tips from generous passengers." And he would live this double life, one as a black man called Mr. Todd and one as a white man called Dr. King. Didn't tell anybody. And only when he died in Albuquerque, because he got tuberculosis, did he confess to the doctor that perhaps his wife, waiting back in Queens with their 5 children, should perhaps be told the story. And so she was told that her name was not actually Mrs. Todd, but it was actually Mrs. King, and that the reason that 2 of the children were as white as the driven snow was because her husband was not black at all and had no black genes in him whatsoever. And then he died. And then the doctor, in a way which sort of plays into the theme of this book, was asked to sign the death certificate. What was the race of the man who died? He struck out white and black and instead wrote by hand a single word, "American." And it seems a wonderful story, that. I mean, it's so eccentric and so strange and so forgotten. And yet, in a way, it sort of sums up the melting pot that this country is.
And what's fascinating about a story like that is this man who also has a great deal to do with the Geologic Survey. I mean, there is a whole diamond scheme uncovered under this man's watch as well.
Yes, I mean, I don't want to think that the book is entirely about King, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there was this astonishing fraud when a couple of prospectors turned up in an office in San Francisco with a bag full of diamonds and said, "We found these. We're not going to tell you where, but we can lead them to you to them if you put on a blindfold." And so they went to the site and found the place peppered with diamonds and emeralds and sapphires and rubies. And a company was set up with a gigantic capitalization in San Francisco. And huge amounts of money were poured into it, making these 2 prospectors enormously rich. But Clarence King, hearing this story and being a good geologist, smelled a rat. He said, "You don't find diamonds, emeralds, rubies and sapphires all in the same place. These 2 people are hoodwinking the bankers." And he uncovered the scheme, and he went to the site and found that what had happened was that these 2, who by now had taken $650,000 in cash and scarpered, had simply bought some industrial diamonds in London and had tamped them into the ground with walking sticks and left them for people to find. They had salted the diamond field. So Clarence King was a remarkable geological detective, and he would have been distinguished for that alone. But history actually plays tricks, and he's more distinguished for something else.
You have a knack for that, of finding these people who have been overlooked by history, which brings up a question that came up to me several times in reading the book, which is, do you have a theory as to why that happens? How people become either overlooked or eclipsed by others?
It is weird, isn't it? I mean, I suppose the first of the books in which such a person fascinated me was The Professor and the Madman, which is about this man, W.C. Minor, who was totally overlooked by history. And I found him merely in a footnote in a specialist book about dictionaries. Why are people so ill-treated by history? And I think the fact is that it is so... It's rather like celebrity culture today. History awards sort of pole position to a small number of celebrities. And the lesser people who play an ancillary role in the story become more and more ancillary as time goes on. You know, everyone writes about Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth, but we tend to forget lesser figures who probably are just as fascinating. So part of my job, if you like, I mean, it's purely self-assigned because I just find it fascinating, is to rake up these figures who have been forgotten and say, he shouldn't be forgotten at all. He should be a figure of equal stature to the main figures of history, and often become rather more important. I mean, everyone in the lexicographical trade remembers James Murray, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Right.
Now, partly thanks to the relative success of the book about W.C. Minor, everyone says, oh, the Oxford English Dictionary, that's had that crazy chap who did this amazing job. And people tend to forget Murray now. What was the editor of the time? But we remember W.C. Minor because he was in a lunatic asylum for 40 years and yet did this wonderful, wonderful work. So if this, I mean, I don't deliberately look for such people, but when they swim into my ken, as it were, I'm jolly well going to write about them.
As we wrap up, I find it such a pleasure in reading your work because you have such a passion for the subjects that you're writing about. And I think sometimes that is missing from the history that we read. But I assume that comes from a love of this country and a love of those characters that you have discovered.
Massachusetts figures hugely in this story. And yeah, all sorts of creatures come out of the woodwork in Massachusetts, particularly one who, if you like, facilitates the conversation we're having today. Man who's long forgotten. I mean, have you heard of Reginald Aubrey Fessenden? He worked for the U.S. Weather Bureau. He was actually a Canadian. And he worked out technically how to broadcast voice as opposed to Morse code. I mean, everyone knows that Samuel Morse invented the telegraph and Morse code. He worked out how to transmit the kind of thing that we're doing, or playing music or reciting poetry or whatever. And from an aerial in Massachusetts, a place called Brant Rock, not far from Plymouth Rock, oddly enough, he broadcast the first ever non-Morse code to go out on the wireless. And he transmitted it on Christmas Eve, 1906. He sent a message by Morse to all the radio operators on the United Fruit Company's ships that were beating up the Western Atlantic, full largely of bananas from Central America going to Boston and Baltimore and Charleston and so forth. He said, listen out at 1 minute to midnight on Christmas Eve. And so they listened, and it was a stormy night. There was a blizzard, apparently, off Boston. Seas were tremendous. These miserable radio operators clamped their earphones to their ears, and instead of hearing the normal stuff that they would hear on the radio, they in fact heard something very, very different and very wonderful.
It is so beautiful, I guess also in the fact that it was Christmas Eve. I mean, it's a beautiful story.
It is, I think. And he then recited the Lord's Prayer, and using his own voice to do that, then wished everyone at sea a very happy Christmas and New Year. And by doing so, he, if you like, inaugurated the national radio conversation. And if anything, united the country more than radio. I mean, that image of the family huddled beside the great big radio set listening to Amos on Andy or, you know, some of those great shows of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, that's where it all began.
It's just one of the many fascinating stories. The name of the book is The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. Simon Winchester, it is always a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for spending time.
It's always great to be with you, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.